This week, the music artist Neil Young demanded that Spotify censor and remove from its platform the biggest podcaster, Joe Rogan, after he interviewed the scientist Robert Malone. For those who do not know Malone, he is a biochemist and a physician trained at the University of California, San Diego, Northwestern Medical School, and Harvard Medical School. He was a pioneer of mRNA technology that was used to create the COVID vaccine. Malone is currently chief medical officer of Alkheim Laboratories. On the Joe Rogan podcast, Robert Malone questioned the efficacy of the vaccine and its boosters, among other controversial statements. Despite Neil Young's demands, Spotify decided to keep Joe Rogan as a podcaster for its platform. And as a result, Neil Young, as well as Joni Mitchell, removed their music from Spotify's platform to protest the company's unwillingness to censor Joe Rogan and Robert Malone. Ari, you listened to the Joe Rogan podcast with Robert Malone. What did you think of the discussion? And do you think it's appropriate to silence or censor Dr. Malone?
I personally found it enlightening, even though I don't agree with almost half of the things that Dr. Malone says. I think it is important to have an open society. We're living in America where we have the freedom of speech. And I think the problem, once you start to censor people and kick them off Twitter and kick them off LinkedIn and Instagram, you don't know who to trust. And I think that's fair in North Korea, but in the United States of America, you could fight misinformation or disinformation in other ways by promoting true, real information above and beyond their misinformation.
How do you distinguish the difference between misinformation and disinformation?
Misinformation is just not knowing the right facts, and you're just not aware of them. Disinformation is purposely giving over wrong information to lead people astray for whatever ulterior motive you have. So when you read closely through the transcript or you listen to the podcast, Robert Malone seems like a brilliant man and he's very smart. When you look at the fine details, you'll find areas where he's blatantly anti-vaccine. And there is a danger to that if people believe it is true. So I think that there's definitely truth to so many things that he says. He is 100% right. We needed to focus on early treatment instead of hospital treatment early on. Why didn't they do that?
On one of Joe Rogan's podcasts on COVID, there was discussion of the side effects from the vaccine, like myocarditis in young men. All right, we spoke about this risk last week on the podcast. In particular, you mentioned that 8 out of 100,000 young men were experiencing heart inflammation from the vaccine, but nobody died, and like 2 out of 100,000 had a serious case. You speculated that getting COVID for a young man is likely much more dangerous in the long run than taking the vaccine.
There are a lot of things that he says that make sense, but then when he goes into the vaccines and he talks about the myocarditis, which has definitely been recognized. If you look in the CDC, they recognize anaphylaxis, Guillain-Barré syndrome, all possibilities that you can get from a vaccine. And they're very upfront about what the problems are. Just to give you an example, Peter McCullough's talk, they talk about the numbers when they talk about myocarditis, very elevated compared to what the reality is. One example in the Peter McCullough talk is he says 18,000 fatalities related to the vaccine. First of all, that would be 539 million people vaccinated. And that's still a 0.0022%. But still, it makes you feel like you're doing something wrong if you take the vaccine. Also, threat to reproduction, Alzheimer's disease. He is just sowing vaccine hesitancy.
Do you believe that if a podcast does not follow the advice of the medical establishment or the CDC, that that podcast or that information should not be made available to the public? And if so, what should the criteria for doing so?
The only way to fight misinformation and disinformation is really to know what people are really saying so that you could verify it, look it up, research it. It only makes you better and understanding what the reality is. There are consequences to spreading misinformation. Instead of closing down free speech, you have to deal with the consequences of spreading misinformation. For instance, Spotify wanted to have Joe Rogan. They lost $2 billion in 4 days because of that decision. Kyrie Irving, great basketball player, decided he didn't want to get vaccinated. So he missed all the home games so far this year. So, but you don't kick him off the team. That's not right. That's not freedom of speech, but you have to deal with the consequences of your actions.
We use expressions like you have to follow the science, but the reality is that we really never know the truth. Scientists create hypotheses, then we create experiments, and the evidence matches the hypothesis or it doesn't. When evidence arises that pokes a hole in our theories, we go back to the drawing board. When COVID started, scientists and doctors were confused, and there was a lot of guesswork. Some ideas turned out to be right, and others turned out to be wrong. For example, doctors thought that zinc provided a benefit to COVID patients, but zinc, in controlled randomized experiments, did not improve COVID patients' health, and then that treatment was abandoned. Given that we're all still in the dark about many aspects related to the vaccine, boosters, treatments, and the long-term effects of having COVID, why do you think it makes sense to limit the conversation only to those ideas that are widely accepted by scientists right now, instead of broadening the discussion to include views that challenge the orthodoxy?
I think that's a beautiful point, and that's how you have to embrace people like Robert Malone and Peter McCullough, because even if I vehemently disagree with them, and I think that they're spreading anti-vax sentiment, which has really killed many people. Unfortunately, many people have not taken the vaccines. Even if they themselves were vaccinated, they spread it. So it's unfortunate. But that being said, they also do make the medical community more cognizant of the risks, which there are. So for instance, J&J is not your first choice, right? Your mRNA vaccines are your first choice when it comes to getting a vaccine because the safety data is better.
Ari, you favor the use of vaccines, but I suspect that you favor Pfizer, Moderna over J&J.
Even the J&J overall vaccine safety data is there. It's just you might as well use the safer one. So we've adapted, and it's partly because there is a voice on the other side. And instead of shutting people out, you have to be open-minded, listen to them, and say why they're mistaken. People like Vladimir Zelenko, I mean, they're so outrageous that I still wouldn't take him out. I would want to hear it because it shows a lot of people how insane it is talking about microchips and vaccines. It's sort of so obvious to most people that it discredits a lot of the other things that he says as well. So it is important to just be open-minded.
In our previous episode of What Happens Next, we had a conversation with James Meigs, who spoke on the Wuhan lab leak. When that concept was first mentioned by Donald Trump and others, the magazine editors at Lancet condemned it and silenced this possibility even before there was an investigation. Why would one of the leading scientific journals behave this way?
Yeah, I think that's a huge mistake. It just makes you double down more. All these people probably wouldn't be as loud and wouldn't be as noticed if they weren't shunned.
All right, at the beginning of COVID, you recognize that COVID lives in the upper throat and that it might make sense to rinse with Listerine or iodine to kill the COVID virus, to reduce its spread to others, and possibly to help the patient as well.
When you take somebody off YouTube, it's enraging. I was taken off in the beginning just for posting that Listerine and iodine rinse might work. I wasn't saying to do it, but I sort of came around and I understood. But at the same time, it's really enraging when you're like, oh my God, I'm living in the United States of America and they took me down. I took my video down.
How should the leading medical journals respond to scientists, doctors, or non-experts that disagree with the conclusions of the medical establishment?
Lancet and the New England Journal of Medicine, what they probably should have done is they should have maybe not mentioned Robert Malone to give them notoriety, but write down the key points and go one by one why this anti-vaxxer sentiment is incorrect.
One of the points that Robert Malone made during his two-hour interview with Joe Rogan was that natural immunity is superior to the vaccine, meaning getting COVID protects you better than getting the vaccine for future COVID variants.
He says natural immunity is 13 times superior than vaccine-induced immunity. Well, then you could explain that in the beginning, the vaccine-induced immunity was better than natural immunity. Then after Delta, things did change. natural immunity seemed to be more protective than vaccine, but only by like 2 to 4 times as much. That would be much more useful than to attack these people directly. It is important to demonstrate why, what ulterior motives these people have. I think there's a great article by Tom Bartlett, everybody should read, about Robert Malone called The Vaccine Spreading Vaccine Misinformation. He speculates as to why Robert Malone is perhaps bitter, because he was not given the credit that he thought he was deserving of. He actually called what happened to himself intellectual rape.
Ari, what should the process be to censor misinformation about COVID? And maybe we could use your own personal experience when you were censored for recommending using Listerine as an example.
I think they have people assigned on the internet that are supposed to go out on Instagram, Twitter, YouTube, and their job is to, at that time at least, any unverified treatment, unverified meaning it's not NIH approved, we should censor and block it. I don't think it's a scientist looking at it. It's not somebody who knows that actually there was a publication in a journal about it. But I understand at that time that there were so many questions, and I could sort of understand why it needed to be squashed. But what I think they should have thought about more is just putting a link, which now they have, but a better link saying, hey, why this is not really approved yet, why it's not out there. So they could have battled things much better by not squashing things. They should have verified to show you exactly what is effective and what is evidence-based, and let you say what you wanted to say, because there was actually no therapy at the time.
What scientific evidence do you feel best justifies taking the mRNA COVID vaccine?
Just looking at the latest data showing the hospitalization rate for unvaccinated adults is now 67 per 100,000. Vaccinated adults is 5 per 100,000. I mean, that just came out today. The rate of a vaccinated teen is 1 per 1 million. So whatever side effects, and they are real side effects of the vaccines, are outweighed by the benefits. And somebody like Robert Malone and Peter McCullough might sow distrust in the vaccine, leading to vaccine hesitancy that is still prevalent.
New topic. I want to talk about some of the latest COVID innovations that the audience should start to follow. There have been some recent studies related to using the sewer system to monitor COVID in your community. Why are you so excited about this?
Because SARS is a respiratory virus, and it's shed into the environment through coughing, sneezing, speaking, and breathing. But it's also found in urine and feces. So they have this dashboard called COVID Poops 19 dashboard. And Johns Hopkins has a dashboard of all the cases of COVID from the very beginning. They also have this dashboard where they have these places where they check sewage for the coronavirus viruses inside the sewage. So it's pretty incredible. They look for viruses in the wastewater, and they have 58 countries, 3,000 plus sites, and they could tell if there's a new outbreak going to happen based on the sewage viral levels. So they were just researching the coronavirus in the New York City wastewater. They have been doing it over the past year, and they noticed weird sequences of the virus, and they call it cryptic lineages. And there are speculations that it's either from people whose infections aren't being sequenced or from virus-infected animals like rats.
I didn't realize that rats could even get COVID. Can they spread the virus, and can it result in other mutations?
It could explain what we discussed last week, the saltational mutation, where you can get weird mutations that are above and beyond the normal adaptive evolution.
How can we use this sewer information to improve public health?
New Zealand uses it primarily as an early warning system. So it's new detections. So in certain cities, they'll analyze it every week or two, and they'll see if they see viruses that pop up, then they know that, boom, their city has an infection. I'm sure they do it in China, because China right now apparently is COVID-free.
Since Omicron is not particularly dangerous, Do you think foreign societies should lock down to prevent the spread of Omicron at a significant economic and societal cost, or should they just rip off the Band-Aid and return to a more normal life?
I personally believe they should lift the Band-Aid up. Of course, China has an ulterior motive right now with the Olympics, but eventually it's going to break through. You can't be locked down forever. And we live in a society where people are traveling, so it might have worked hundreds of years ago, but now it's inevitable that they'll have a break at some point, and it might be a mutation that's going to be more difficult. So,
do you think lockdowns are effective at reducing death rates?
I'm not a fan, and I don't know if you saw the article in the Johns Hopkins about the lockdown not really being effective or just having like a 0.2% effect, but the lockdowns were not that effective in mortality.
I know you're also excited about using your breath to do a rapid COVID test. Tell us about the efficacy and simplicity of using a breath test.
Coronavirus has a specific breath print, and Ohio State University published an article a few months back how you could, with an 88% accuracy, tell the difference between COVID and non-COVID in a hospital setting. They're working on an outpatient breathalyzer as well. They've had a rapid breath test called the Spironose in the Netherlands. That was employed, I believe, by the music festival that they had months back. And Children's Hospital of Philadelphia has one. Rutgers University has one. I recently spoke to the CEO of Breath of Health in Israel. They've been working on a COVID breath test. Again, the advantage of having something like that, you can imagine going into a basketball game, instead of showing your vaccine card, you could just walk in with a breath test and you feel more comfortable that you're COVID negative. There's an article that's supposed to be published, according to the Breath of Health CEO, within the next 2 weeks in the European journals.
I want to change topics to the decline in the prevalence of COVID. I live in Miami Beach, and today I passed two outdoor COVID testing sites, one in Miami and the other in Miami Beach. For the past few weeks, there have been a long lines. Today, there was nobody in line. This could be purely anecdotal, but what are you seeing out there, Ari?
I went to the COVID center as well because I had a severe sore throat, and I had coronavirus OH63, which is not COVID, but I did get tested, and the line was about three people. It's incredible. So we're, thank God, at a downslope, and the hospital is seeing the same.
Ari, can you speak about another recent invention to protect yourself against COVID? Instead of wearing a mask, you would use an intranasal spray that would be applied like you now use Afrin. The spray would be a prophylactic against COVID in the nose. Ari, what do you make of this idea?
What are some of the intranasal options for COVID? So right now there are no approved intranasal prophylactic anti-SARS medicines. But let's say you're going to a football game or a basketball game, or whatever, you want to be protected for 4 hours, you know, can you take something? In the very beginning of COVID, there was an article from China, which fascinated me. It was intranasal interferon, and it was a positive trial. What they did is they treated the healthcare workers in a certain hospital. You know, they all got intranasal interferon and the other group didn't, and it was dramatic. The ones with intranasal interferon were less likely to have COVID. And that was really early on, the first 3 months. So that's why I was interested in the possibility of intranasal iodine, which we talked previously. There is this study out of the Netherlands. It's TriSB92, which is published in one of the journals recently, where it doesn't competitively bind with the ACE2 receptor, but it changes the conformation of the spike protein so that the spike protein of the coronavirus can't attach to the ACE2 receptor. So, and it actually has shown to inhibit SARS-CoV-2 in mice. So they're going to be working on that nasal spray. The other two nasal sprays, one of them, it was against the regular coronavirus, studied many years ago, and it was published in the journal Nature. And what that would do is it would have a protective barrier, actually use cold trypsin from fish, cod trypsin, and it would be a barrier against the coronavirus from infecting the lungs. You would be sick for 1 day less. There is another intranasal spray called Tafix It's in Israel, T-A-F-F-I-X. And this, I think, is very fascinating. 4 months ago, during the Hebrew New Year, the percent positivity at that time was 18 to 25%. And what they did is, in Bnei Brak, it's a city where they're all crunched together in the synagogue. So 160 people did not use it, and about 80 people used it. And only 2 out of the 80 people who used this Tafix, intranasal Tafix, that's 2.4%, developed COVID, whereas 10% of the non-users were infected. Tafix is an intranasal spray, which is a powder, and it blocks the influx of COVID. I'm just making the point that there could be future ways as a prophylactic measure, even if it's not for COVID, it might be for other respiratory illnesses. They are going to be working on a intranasal COVID vaccine soon enough.
Why do you think intranasal spray prophylactics will be a potential game changer?
It's a game changer because all these respiratory viruses have to get into your oropharynx to infect you. And you're not going to have to deal with any anti-vaxxer sentiment. You just do a spray and you're golden. And also, it's going to be good, hopefully, for the variants as well.
And it will allow you to go in public without fear?
Correct.
All right. Thanks, as always, for joining us.
I'll catch you later. Bye.